Hi everyone, I'm Dr. Dustin Costescu. I'm an associate professor of obstetrics and gynecology at McMaster University, where I work as a family planning and sexual health specialist. A group of us attended the European Society of Gynecology conference virtually over the last few weeks, and we wanted to rapidly provide you with some information about some of our key learning. I'm joined right now by Dr. Julie Thorne. She's going to tell us about one of the sessions that she attended, and then we're going to learn what she has to say and some of her reflections on that. So Julie, why don't you start by telling us about yourself and tell us what you learned.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Costescu, for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk about this presentation, which I think is a bit of a clinical conundrum that we all grapple with on a regular basis. So as you mentioned, I'm Julie Thorne. I'm an OBGYN and the family planning lead for contraception and abortion care at Women's College Hospital and Mount Sinai Hospital. I'm going to tell you about this talk by Professor Martin Burkhauser, which was focusing on impaired peak bone mass in hormonal contraception. Is it a reality or is it a myth? So, you know, the premise for this talk is really that the evidence and knowledge on the impact of hormonal contraceptives on bone is poorly understood. We have different progesterones in our contraceptives. We can consider levonorgestrel as a more classic progesterone that's considered more androgenic and may promote bone growth. And newer progestins may have a better metabolic profile for the reasons we're using them, but higher suppression of the hypothalamic pituitary axis and less androgenic activity. And so as we consider contraceptive use in our patient population, questions remain. Does hormonal contraceptive affect acquisition of a normal peak bone mass? And how does it actually impact practically or for the health of the patient? Does it actually affect their future fracture risk? So there are some studies that have tried to look at this. These are some of the ones that they listed around combined hormonal contraceptives. One prospective controlled study by Pomeroy et al. In 2004 looked at 370 adolescents ages 12 to 18 years, and they gave them a low-dose ethinyl estradiol and levonorgestrel combined pill or no hormonal therapy, and looked at their bone mass gain or their bone mineral density gain in the lumbar spine. And there was a difference in gain. So those who were on the combined hormonal pills seemed to have less gain in that bone density than those who were not on any hormonal therapy. This is similar to findings in other studies, be it on a slightly older age group, 18 to 24, as well as another study on adolescents. And these were all in low dose ethinyl estradiol pills and looking at over a 12 to 24 month period. These findings were supported by a meta-analysis. So this was published just recently, and the aim of this study was to look over 12 months, the weighted mean difference in mean absolute change from baseline in the spinal area of BMD in adolescents using combined hormonal contraceptives versus those who are not. There were not many studies. There was a lot of heterogeneity appropriated to the study, but the takeaway from it is that, yes, there is less bone mineral density gain in adolescents who are using combined hormonal contraceptives. There was a Cochrane review on looking at fracture risk that was published in 2015. This included 7 case control studies and 7 cohort studies. There are no randomized control trials that look at this. The contraceptives examined in the Cochrane analysis included combined oral contraceptives, depomedroxyprogesterone acetate, which is the intramuscular injection we're all familiar with, and then the hormonal IUD. Only 6 of these studies, which were all in the oral contraceptives, had moderate or high quality evidence. In those 6 studies, only one of them looked at fracture risk in young women. And their takeaway from that was actually in the older women, it doesn't seem to impact fracture risk at all. But in that one study that looked at young women, including adolescents, there was a relative risk of 1.2 for an increase in fracture risk. So the takeaway was younger users may have a higher fracture risk. but there wasn't necessarily an adequate sub-analysis to correlate that with low peak bone mass and what that might mean over time. There's no data for other forms of hormonal contraceptives. So you can get combined hormonal contraceptives in a ring or a contraceptive patch. There was one pilot study, but it was very, very small numbers. And so there's not really any reliable data available on their effect on bone density in adolescents or other users. And there's no data yet on newer contraceptive formulations that use more natural forms of estrogen, like estetrol or a natural estradiol or E2. There's some thought that these newer estrogens may lead to a reduction in bone resorption, which in that might actually be better. So you maintain peak bone density for where previously maybe there was more breakdown. If we consider progesterone-only contraceptives for other data on the depo-medroxyprogesterone acetate, there was a 3-year longitudinal follow-up study in women aged 16 to 33 years. DMPA users lost 3.7% of their density in their spine and 5.2% in their femoral necks versus the bone density in controls that were not on anything. And the loss was greatest in younger users. And some of this data was really what led to the black box labeling that still exists for Depo-Provera. Case control studies on fracture risk using this UK database, they did find a correlation that users who filled more than 10 prescriptions versus non-DMPA users, their adjusted odds ratio was 1.54. Hinting that there may be a correlation there. And then there was a Cochrane review, but it only included 2 case control studies. And they also concluded that there may be an increased fracture risk in these users if they took it for more than 4 years with an odds ratio of 2.16. There's no data on fracture risk associated with DMPA when used by adolescents. There's one study on the levonorgestrel intrauterine device on fracture risk, where they actually found a correlation with perhaps a reduced fracture risk for ever use or for long-term use. There's no data on bone density or fracture risk with desogestrel tablets, and no data on fracture risk in adolescents with etanogestrel implants. There is some data on bone density that was not presented in this talk. So the conclusions or takeaways that Professor Birkhauser had was overall, the evidence from observational studies does not indicate an association between combined hormonal contraceptives use and fracture risk, but low dose combined hormonal contraceptives may lead to reduced peak bone mass if used in adolescents and decreased bone mass in young adults with unstable cycles. DMPA does have a negative impact on bone density in women of all ages, and there may be an increased fracture risk. And DMPA leads to a reduced peak bone mass if used in adolescents and young adults. And then, interestingly, a little bit of data that may imply that hormonal IUD users could be associated with a decreased fracture risk. So I spent a little bit of time trying to digest all this information and how it correlates to practice. My interpretation of the data. The idea that low-dose DOCs might impact peak bone mass acquisition is compelling. It certainly seems convincing that there may be a real association there. What this means for long-term fracture risk or the risk of osteoporosis is unknown. Our society guidelines do recommend that DMPA users optimize their calcium and vitamin D intake, engage in weight-bearing exercise, and reduce cigarette, caffeine, and alcohol use in order to optimize their bone health. And those with otherwise optimal bone health, if they cease using Depo-Provera, their bone density will bounce back. The Canadian Pediatric Society does recommend using combined hormonal contraceptives with at least 30 to 35 micrograms ethinyl estradiol over a low dose as a means to manage their periods and their bleeding better, but also because of this potential association and this hope that it will optimize their bone density and their bone growth. There is biological plausibility that later generation progesterone-only pills could impair peak bone mass acquisition that may have to do with their anti-androgenic activity and suppression of the HPA or hypothalamic pituitary axis. And whether these effects are transient or permanent remains unknown. And then this idea that some of the natural estrogens that are coming out or higher dose estrogen pills may actually be a strategy to mitigate this risk is also interesting and worth further exploration. I wonder a little bit about why or what the biologic plausibility could be for a levonorgestrel IUD to increase bone mass. Is this because most women are cycling and therefore they have circulating estrogen at that time? Is it the androgenic activity of the levonorgestrel, even though there's much lower systemic levels? And could there be an association that because they're using a long-acting reversible contraceptive, maybe for longer periods of time, they're actually experiencing less pregnancies than in the past? And pregnancy and lactation can have an association with reduction in bone density. And so is that actually the difference? If we have less pregnancies, we have improved bone density. It is important to couch this concern for bone density on the risk of unplanned pregnancies to adolescents. There's a lot of associated complications from a medical standpoint, but also from a societal standpoint for unplanned pregnancies. And the absolute risk of fracture in adolescence is probably really low and unlikely to outweigh the intended benefits of a hormonal contraceptive. And overall, there's a lack of or some small amounts of low quality data, particularly for adolescents. And so we walk away from this thing, we don't actually have enough information. It'd be really nice to have larger, longer term studies. And that's really difficult to carry out.
So thank you so much, Dr. Thorne. This is an important clinical conundrum. And I think that one of the important takeaways I kind of hear from you is sort of to reiterate, the overall risk of fracture is low in this population, right? Especially younger patients. But, you know, at a population level and certainly for the individual patient in front of us, if there are differences in risk, we want to know what they are to improve our counseling. I'm curious to know how you use the Canadian Pediatric Society recommendations in your own practice. When you're choosing a contraceptive method for an adolescent, do you sort of follow the 30 mics and up? Do you tend to titrate more to symptom relief? Sort of what's your approach or how do you counsel patients on that?
Yeah, so great question. I just definitely think it's a balance between trying to meet guidelines and optimize all the aspects of health as we understand it from a scientific standpoint, as well as balancing it with like a patient-centered approach and the reasons that I'm seeing this adolescent for their contraception or their menstrual management. And so if a combined hormonal pill is appropriate for them, they have the ability to be compliant with it. It seems like a method that might meet their needs. Then yes, I'll preferentially approach it with a 30 or 35 microgram pill. If this is an adolescent who needs contraception, the risk of pregnancy is real, or they need menstrual management, but an estrogen containing option is not realistic for them or not what they choose, then it's about counseling around the risks of the other option and acknowledging that they, if they are having capacity to choose a contraception, they can think about the risks and benefits around the different methods. And if Depo-Provera is something that they know they can be compliant with and will work for them, or they're interested in trying an IUD that again, may or may not make a difference on their bone density, then we approach that. We know the Canadian Pediatric Society also recommends LARCs, or long-acting reversible contraceptives, as their first line, and those are not estrogen containing. And so it's a bit of a balance in revisiting what the team does for activity, whether or not they've started smoking and some, counseling around that and what their calcium and vitamin D exposure is.
Yeah, those are really great points. In my own adolescent population, when we're looking at menstrual management, right, that goal of therapeutic amenorrhea, I think what this study does for me is gives me a bit of reassurance that novel technologies, implants, IUDs, that we tend to like to use are certainly safe from a bone health point of view, because often the comparator is depo-medroxyprogesterone acetate, right? But even in those populations, the day-to-day fracture risk of some of those children is actually quite low. They may be a full transfer. They're not necessarily ambulatory. And so again, I think that, we use the methods that work well and are acceptable to young people and their families. This is really helpful. I think, it just adds to the, is less more is more and more. What do we use? I don't know if we've answered all the problems, but I think it probably gives me a bit of reassurance that we're probably not doing a really bad job when it comes to contraception of bone health, but that there are some nuances to the data. It's not an easy question. And there may be some options that if bone is your priority, that might be a little bit better out there for you. Dr. Thorne, thank you so much for sharing sharing your expertise, your opinions, and your knowledge with us today. And thank you to those of you who've been watching these sessions. Have a great day.